The XTC Podcast.
What do you call that noise?
Welcome to What Do You Call That Noise, the XTC Podcast, where every day is a fantastic day and everyone agrees it's nice to be nice. We're also the home of cheesy introductions. I'm Mark Fisher, and in this episode we're going to be circling round XTC from some of the very earliest gigs to some more recent collaborations, and in fact some very recent collaborations with two wonderful musicians who were there at the time. Before I introduce the guests, it's time for our monthly trip to the XTC Sommeliers, in which our listeners pair the perfect drink with the perfect XTC song.
What do you call that noise?
My name is Florrie Thomas, and I recommend pairing River of Orchids with a gin and tonic with a shot of elderflower cordial. The floral aromatics complement the sprightly pizzicato arrangement in this atmospheric masterpiece. Cheers.
Thank you very much for that. In the first 18 months of the XTC podcast, we've heard from some tremendous guests who have included Dave Gregory, Colin Moulding, Andy Partridge, Hugh Padgham, Stephen Wilson, Andrew Swainson, Stuart Lee, Martin Newell, Chris Butler of The Waitresses, Tom Clark of The Enemy, Laurie Nankervell of Squid, Brian Van Der Ark of The Verve Pipe, Chris Toomey, Tom Bernhardt, fantastic authors, and of course, lots and lots and lots of XTC fans. None of this would have been possible without the brilliant supporters on Patreon. And if you'd like to be one of them and help keep the podcast going, it'd be great if you could check out patreon.com/Mark Fisher. And I'll be name-checking some of those lovely people, the Knights in Shining Karma, at the end of this episode. Oh, and just a reminder that you can get my two XTC books at xtclimelight.com. Right, so let's have some introductions. First, let's go to the Republic of Ireland and say a big welcome to Thomas Walsh. Hello, Thomas.
Hello, everybody. Good evening. Good day. Good morning.
He's very spontaneous, is Thomas.
Well, the amazing thing is you nearly said Shites and Nine in Karma, by the way, in that introduction.
Yeah.
You nearly said it.
That's going to be the new category. There's going to be a fourth category I'm going to introduce, yes. The Shites and
well,
Nine.
Well, can I apologise in advance, because I know Nick's passion is incredible for XTC, but I am a complete and utter nerd. So I will be.
This is actually an XTC support group we're in here.
And, well, the thing is, if anyone says anything wrong fact wise, I will jump in very quickly and probably loudly. So Nick, I apologise in advance, because you're a hardworking man who, you know, deals in the world. I just sat around for decades looking at pictures of Andy. So anyway.
So, Thomas, if I remember rightly, was an original reader of Limelight, yes. My old fanzine, which was before he became Pugwash and released half a dozen albums of gorgeous melodic pop. Thomas was also part of the Ivor Novello Award-nominated Duckworth Lewis Method, a collaboration with the Divine Comedy's Neil Hannon, all about cricket. And he's also collaborated with XTC's Dave Gregory, who did string arrangements on songs including A Rose in a Garden of Weeds and I Want You Back in My Life, and I think some other stuff as well. And songs he's co-written with Andy Partridge include Anchor, My Genius, At the Sea, and Here We Go Round Again. Lovely to have you, Thomas. And so to Florida, where we've heard the laughing already, we can say hello to the equally poptastic Nick Haywood. Hello, Nick.
Hello. How are you going?
Yay!
All the better to have you here. I saw Nick playing in Glasgow in 2018 in a splendid double bill with Thomas, and it was one of those gigs where the hits just kept on coming. Favourite Shirts, Fantastic Day, Love Plus One, Nobody's Fool, Blue Hat for a Blue Day, Whistle Down the Wind. And many of those songs date from the 1982 album Pelican West by Haircut 100, but Nick has a catalogue of music, every bit of good, that goes all the way up to the lovely Woodland Echoes album of 2017. And I hear more songs in the pipeline. And then with me in my kitchen, which is the first time I've had two people in the same room since the very first episode of the XTC podcast, is Kevin Burt. Hello, Kevin.
Right.
Hello, Kev.
Great to have you here.
Hello, Kevin.
I haven't seen Kevin for about 30 years, but he remembers me from when I was a naive 16-year-old thinking it'd be a good idea to write letters to every A. Partridge and C. Moulding in the Swindon phone book with the idea of making a fanzine.
Cool.
It worked. We swapped tapes and he tried to get me into Caravan and I'm afraid failed. And I tried to get him into XTC and it seems succeeded because he's here right now.
Very
and it just so happens Kevin is also a massive Nick Haywood fan. And just happens to be in Edinburgh today. Actually, maybe, Kevin, you could start by describing the cassette tape that you've brought with you. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a tape that Mark did for me, and he's kindly written out all the songs, the year that they were released, what album they were on, the band members, and also lyrics on the back to wait till your boat goes down. So fill in two sides of A4 paper.
Catalogue numbers.
So I managed to keep hold of this for, I think it's 1981. Wow. So it's more like 40 years.
Yeah, it's just its anniversary. So yeah, I mean, I don't know what's even that's weirder, the fact that I did it or the fact that Kevin's kept it all this time. Nick, were you a compilation boy, compilation cassette kid?
Actually, no. I'd pick out a song like Perfect Skin by Lloyd Cole and the Commotions. I'd pick it out and I'd take it into the car on my cassette, and it was just a cassette player in there, and I'd play it over and over and over and over and over and over all day for weeks and months until I couldn't hear it anymore. But the thing is, with Perfect Skin, I can hear that fresh as a daisy any time. I haven't overplayed it, and I think that's what it is with songs that a deep love affair. They just get in there, and that is that. I can hear them over and over and over again. I can hear Moonlight Serenade by Glenn Miller 30 times a day, and I still wouldn't get bored of it. And the next day, I'd be up, and I could still hear it. But there are some songs which you just kind of like go, I can't hear that anymore, you know. And they're brilliant songs, but you just go, I actually can't do that song anymore, you know. And luckily, I haven't got that with my own songs. I can play Fantastic Day over and over. It's really weird. I went through a period of not, you know, falling out of love with them a bit, just because you do when you're growing up, don't you? You just don't want to wear flares anymore, and then you don't want to wear drain pipes, and then you don't wear any trousers, and then you don't wear any pants, and then you don't want to wear anything, and then you go, then you get caught in the forest naked, and then you think, I better start wearing clothes again. But you know what I mean. I'm being silly. But
luckily, this is an audio podcast where none of us is clothed at the moment.
What?
But you know, what's you happening? Just, it's that thing. It's love, clothes, and songs. You know, in that order.
Can I already go back over a few things? Because Kevin, did you try and get Mark into a caravan or actually into caravan? I mean, we really have to clear that up first.
Yeah. No, it definitely was the band.
Cool. Well, that's good.
We're talking about Canterbury Sea, aren't we?
Canterbury Sea,
of course. Apparently still
brilliant caravan.
And Nick, am I right in thinking that you were a caravan fan back
in
the day?
Yeah, I saw them in Croydon Fairford Halls. And then I ended up working with Julian Gordon Hastings, who is Pye's son. And that's who I recorded Kites with, his son. So I recorded Kite.
He worked on Tangled as well, did he?
And Tangled, yeah. Yeah, and I still know Julian, and he's a fireman now in Scotland. And he's still doing music with his father. And they're, you know, it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant to see them, you know, working together. And Pye's just done a new album, and he's releasing it.
Hold on, is there firemen in Scotland? Because in Ireland, there's about six firemen, because it rains so much the fire doesn't have a chance. You know, and basically every winter you see, you know, where you see birds flying south for the winter. Well, you see fire in the sky flying south for the winter in Ireland, because fire hasn't got a fucking hope. So I'll just throw in the odd stupid thing like that as well. But I
tell you,
this
is what it was like driving in the car with you, Thomas. It was brilliant. I'll tell you guys the amount of stories I heard, hilarious stories as well. And
you did also go into your meditation zone. Remember when we got stuck in traffic and I was going on too much?
Oh, that was because I was taking wrong turns, wasn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah. But I got into it and it was fine. And we got there, didn't we? We got there on time.
Of course we did. You always got there. But you just go back to say, you said Lloyd Cole. It's amazing because I only taught that song the other day, and that was a big song for me, actually, I remember. You know, because I was a huge, you know, obviously big Beatles fan very early on, a huge ELO fan. But in the 80s, and that's why we get on to XTC, in the 80s, something happened in the music that was way away from what you were being given. And you had to go looking for it. And there was no internet, of course, and all that stuff. But it's the odd thing would permeate, and Perfect Skin permeated. And you permeated with the songs. And the thing was, the only thing, when it comes to Lloyd Cole, he's kind of revered probably a bit more than you are, Nick, simply because he had a bit of a frowny face. And you smiled and enjoyed it. And that's the thing about a Crowded House are like that. Crowded House always enjoyed their music. And I don't think they're given the credit sometimes that they deserve, because they always had fun in their music. And I've always had that as well, the fun aspect. And I always think it's almost detrimental sometimes to the actual...
Oh, definitely.
You know, what do you think? And I mean, Perfect Skin is such a great song.
I've got a thing. Actually, Tom, I'd be interested to know what both of you think about this. I've got a theory that when I try and describe the music I like... It's, or maybe conversely, don't like. Yeah. It's the music I don't like is music that doesn't have a sense of humour. And it doesn't mean that I'm into the Baron Knights and comedy records. Exactly. It's just that maybe the wit that manifests itself in a good joke also manifests itself into a good pop song, a sense of the absurd or the passion of life. Does that ring?
Let's go straight for the greatest, the Beatles. I mean, were they ever not funny? When they were serious.
Lennon was serious and funny at the same time.
Yes,
you know,
exactly.
And like when he was recording Imagine, and, you know, he's singing this heartfelt lyric, and then he calls the engineer a C-U-N-T. It's hilarious. You know, it's like, you know, he's just about to do this great lyric, and he's like, hey, you dropped me in there, you fucking, you know.
And it's like... Fucking hell, Phil. Come
just
on,
so,
Phil.
Brilliant. You know, that is John Lennon. When you see him there, he's like the Libran guy, isn't he? He's balanced. He's like two guys fighting against each other, you know, at the same time.
Yeah, and the first person to show, behind the scenes that, you know, you don't make a song like Imagine and it's like Imagine. You make a song like Imagine and your hair's all over the place because you've had a shitty sleep and you've had a shitty day. And you go in and you're trying to do a vocal take, it's not working, and you course and you hit things and you kick things and you give out to Phil Spector, obviously, which is a normal thing to do. And, you know, it's just, that's exactly another great aspect of that kind of classic band and those classic people. They showed you what it was like. They showed reality. And just getting back to, obviously, getting XTC in here, because it is an XTC podcast.
Oh, yeah.
We have to talk a lot about loving them. When I found XTC... You know, late 70s in my head. I heard Nigel, obviously, and I loved it, but I didn't buy it because I was still buying ELO all the time and all that stuff. And then when I heard Senses Working Overtime, I bought it, and I seen it on Top of the Pops, and I remember thinking to myself, all the world is biscuit-shaped. That's the greatest lyric I've ever heard.
Just for me to feed my face.
The guy is wearing roundy glasses, and he has a tweed jacket on, and he's playing an acoustic guitar, and it's 1982 or 81, Top of the Pops. I mean, it didn't make sense, but it made a hell of a lot of sense because they looked brilliant. They sounded amazing. So I bought the single. I flipped it over. The B-sides were mental, and I couldn't get into them at 12, at 13 at that time, apart from the classics hit. So it took me another 3-4 years when I heard Grass, and I did actually a little bit of pee came out when I heard it. And
it's a moment, isn't it? That, I mean,
it is a moment, yeah.
That's pop. You know, a lot of bands, a lot of artists all probably just went, oh, yeah. You know, they've done it. They've done it there.
And look at the time it was. It was the height of, say, Madonna. It was, you know, it was the height of hip-hop and the stuff that we were getting thrown at us with MTV. But because MTV was still a music channel 24/7, you know, at 4 o'clock in the morning, I used to leave my video running, my 3-hour videos running overnight, because I knew they'd show Grass at some stage. And that's how I got
brilliant video as well.
Yeah, 2 hours and 20 minutes into a cassette one night, there it was.
Yeah.
And I always remember Eddie Grant was on before it, and, you know, and I think Luther Vandross was on after it. So, you know, because I played it so many times. And,
well, for
you know,
us pop fans and guitar fans and, you know, Beatles fans and stuff, and, you know, ELO fans and references to that, it was a bit of a ray of hope, wasn't it? It was like,
it was huge.
And they've hit the target there in amongst all this other stuff. that you felt that you couldn't really relate to.
Yeah, absolutely huge. And, you know, in a way, I don't think even the band can respect, and I don't mean that, excuse me, I don't mean that they don't respect it. I mean, they sometimes don't know how important they were, you know, and still are. And even more so in a way now, even though they're not out and about and being a band at the moment. It's just...
They've done it, haven't they? They've painted those pictures for us. So, exactly. You know, when I hear 1,000 Umbrellas, you know, because when I first heard that song, I just thought, that's the string sound. That's right there. That's the string sound I've always wanted to hear. Somehow, that was made. And that moment where Todd Rundgren and XTC, and I know there's lots of stuff around it, but, you know, as a listener, we're just listening to it just going, wow. Yeah, wow. Wow, this is amazing.
And Nick, I'm fascinated. Could you have seen that coming? Because I think what we need to know is how you got into XTC. But I was just listening to a podcast that you've just done, and I did some research here, and this is really interesting. You saw XTC at the Croydon Greyhound, I believe. And I did. There's a fantastic Optimism's Flames website where you can check out every gig that XTC ever did. The only gig they ever played at the Croydon Greyhound was the 22nd of January 1978. That was two days after White Music was released. So you were right at the very, very start there. And I'm just thinking, A, I want to hear that story again, but Brilliant. B, could you have imagined that the band you were seeing for the first time might have been the band who ended up doing all of those songs that you just talked about?
Well, it was that moment. You know, when I'd seen Stardust and I'd looked at the cinema, you looked at film and you think that's what I'd like to do, but it wasn't actually possible. And then at that gig, at that time, when I'd seen a picture before, there was these great pictures going around. One was of David Byrne with his 12-string Sunburst semi-acoustic guitar and a yellow Fred Perry with Tina Weymouth just behind him with a Bob and a Fender Mustang bass. And that picture was kind of, it was that, and then there was Andy Partridge in a Hawaiian shirt. And I'd not seen a Hawaiian shirt since Andy Fairweather Lowe on Top of the Pops with Wide Eyed and Legless. But this was different. This was great song though, isn't it?
Great song.
And I liked Plimsolls. I think that's one of the reasons I liked Andy Fairweather Lowe, because I saw him in some beaten up Plimsolls once. But
well, Stackridge had the last Plimsoll.
Ah.
Great song.
Ah, I have to check that.
Check that out. Check out Stackridge as well, Nick.
I'm writing this down. Okay.
Sorry, okay. The Man the Bowler Hat was on the 73 album produced by George Martin. And it has to be heard to be believed. It's so good. It's the Beatles in the 70s. It's George Martin in Air Studios. It's full orchestras. It's incredible. And they became the Corgis. Everybody's got to learn sometime. That's Stackridge.
Brilliant, brilliant song.
I just thought I'd digress, but I think Andy would appreciate a bit of Stackridge.
Pick those things out. They're like little bits of stitching, aren't they, that just need to be there. You know, otherwise the garment will just collapse.
But go back to the Hawaiian short.
Yeah. So we're just tailors, really, aren't we? stitching something together here. So,
that's true.
Yeah, so I'm there, and I'd seen these pictures that are kind of these details that have really kind of drawn you in. But then I was there at that gig, and it was that moment where when they were doing Neon Shuffle, and they do that thing where when the power stops, that moment, and they live, I think they just made it a bit longer, because on the album it's not short, but you can hear the sort of rhythm. Now, I hadn't really learnt bars and stuff like that. I was just like somebody that had seen Stardust, somebody that had dreamt about doing something. But then this was my moment of, I stopped with them. Couldn't believe that they'd all stopped together. I couldn't believe that I was hearing such tight playing as well. Because, you know, I'd tried a little bit of music and, you can't get this tight. You know, the music that I wanted to make, they were making. I couldn't even get anywhere near it. This was early days. So that was the stars in my eyes moment where I just looked up at them all stopping. I saw, you know, Colin Mauldin's Bob. And then I saw Andy Partridge's twisted expression, frozen. you know, Barry Andrews kneading is kind of like he was like a baker kneading some dough, you know, this keyboard in front of him with dogs breathing written down the side of it. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
And then, you know, and I, you know, Terry Chambers just kind of so in charge, you know, so in charge, but they all stopped together. And in that moment,
a cymbals 20 feet in the air.
Yeah. And I kind of like spun out of it, like spun. If I was making a film of this, it would literally be where you kind of fly around the sky and you go off into the universe and, you know, and then you kind of go back, zoom, you're back in there and you go, right, that's it. I'm doing this. This is what I want to do. That is it. These guys in a band playing like this, sounding like some kind of like twisted Cockney rebel. Yeah, this is art pop at its best. This is Bob's, Mustangs, strings. You know, this is Music Master where it's only one pickup. This is not eight pickups like rock. This is like one pickup. That's so cool. The guitarist and the members, you know, Sound of the Suburbs, he had one pickup. It was like, to me, that was God, you know, to see one pickup, not two. You know, this wasn't the Boys Are Back in Town. This wasn't three pickups or two pickups. Or, you know, this was just like art pop and it blew my head off. I just thought, I want this.
Don't slag Tin Lizzy.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't go there because I'm huge. Oh, you know, I had my you know, Thin Lizzy period and it was just like, oh, yeah. You know, I can still, Boys Are Back in Town is one of the songs I can listen to over and over and over again. Is that? Yeah, well, and Sarah, of course.
I'm just throwing in the, but you're dead right in the, with the stop in Neon Shuffle, especially because, you know, I think there's a great recorded live version where, you know, it's completely arbitrary. Andy can stop and wait for Terry's snare hit back in. I mean, it could be 10 minutes. You know, it could be anything. Because, I mean, it just went... That was you know, anything. And you know, and that's
a band playing, isn't it? At that,
because
they've
exactly.
done all their. They were so at the toy. Height of their Prowse at that
exactly.
particular point,
exactly.
wasn't they? They were Ian Prowse.
And I mean, he famously pissed his trousers, didn't he, during that time when they supported Blondie? That was another one where he talks about he got so excited by the gig. It was such a sweaty gig, such a really amazing gig that he peed himself. I'm sure, Mark, you know that story.
I've forgotten it, but keep
really?
On going.
Really? Yeah. That's quite a famous Andy one where he when he spoke about the live work at that time, when people say, oh, do you not miss it and all that? And he goes, well, you know, no, not now. But at the time, I remember gigs, especially the gig with Blondie we did. I think it was London. Maybe it was Manchester somewhere. Not quite sure. But it was such a powerful gig and they were playing so good and the crowd were right in their face that he literally, with the sweat and everything, he just pissed himself on the stage. And he says he always remembers that.
Quite punk, isn't it?
well, it's also the way they were making the crowd feel because, I mean, I had the very, very great pleasure of sitting in Andy's front room and jamming with Andy and Dave. You know, that's as close as an XTC gig I'll ever get because I was never at an XTC gig. Of course, you know, I was too young, obviously. But over the years when we got to know Andy, you know, we'd sit in the front room and I'd just say, okay, I'm going to play Living in a Haunted Heart and you're going to listen to me play it and I don't give a shit. I'm going to play your songs to you. I remember poor Dave Gregory one night in Dublin. I sang Skylark and the whole fucking album to Dave. Pissed. Now, he remembers this and he says it was great fun, but I swear to God, I apologise so many times to Dave. I was pissed. And me and Paul Putner, the wonderful actor, comedian, Paul was in Dublin. It was the launch of a Pugwash album. And Dave came over to play the launch and everything. It was a very special time. And we all were pissed afterwards. And Dave was nice and calm, but he was having a great time, of course. And I just said, Skylarkin's going on. I don't fucking care. And of course, it went on and it sounded so great. We were all singing it. Like, there was 20 people in the room all singing every song. And Dave was just sitting there like the king. That was quite a special moment. But I remember, I think, singing Season Cycle into his face because he does a lot of backing vocals on that track. And because he's such a, because he's the nicest man I've ever met, and that's including you, Nick, and you're incredibly beautiful. Dave Gregory is the nicest person on the planet.
It's reflected back at you. You know, I've travelled with you, I know.
Yeah, you know the smells. But the thing is, you know,
good.
Dave is so nice. Dave, you could be pulling his hair and jumping on his back, and he'd still be going, okay, thank you. And, you know, and But I didn't go over the top. But I remember the next day going, you know, the next day when you've done something dodgy and you go, I said, Dave, I can only, and he started laughing, of course, which is why we love him. But you know, that's the music, their music encapsulates you into the point where you can go beyond your bodily functions.
Mm.
And even when Andy talked about pissing himself, I thought, yeah, that makes sense for me. Because if I was playing in XTC in 1979 or 78, I'd have pissed myself.
Yeah. Well, I think Andy's highly charged
person. Yeah.
That on stage, he must have been wrecked every night.
Yeah. The performances are they're so great. Every XTC gig you see or listen to, his guitar playing, that's another thing people rarely talk about. What a guitar player Andy Partridge is. Mm. I mean, it's not alone is it brilliant, he has his own style. And that's very difficult with musicians of any era. You know, he loved Rory Gallagher. You know, he loved classic guitar players. But he didn't play like Rory Gallagher. He played like Django Reinhardt meets Rory Gallagher. Django Gallagher. That's what he played like.
Yeah. I saw Rory Gallagher.
Rory Reinhardt.
I saw Rory at the Albert Hall. I was right down the front with my mate Austin, and we were doing guitar solos right at the front, miming them.
That's amazing.
Bullfrog Blues.
He's a genuinely legendary guy. I'm quite proud he's Irish from Cork. You know, that's a wonderful thing because he was one of the greatest to play. But I loved when I heard Andy saying he was influenced by Rory Gallagher and people like that.
Mm.
Because it comes true in his guitar playing. His bluesy licks blended with the ridiculous jazzy stuff that he loves. Mm. You know, all those weird influences as well he has, as well as the classic things like Rory Gallagher and players like that.
I loved his Ibanez Artist.
Yes.
I remember like falling in love with that.
Nick, do you remember picking her up in the shed?
Yeah.
Do you remember? He had it in the shed, didn't he? He did.
Yeah. I mean, it's weird because when you have moments like that, you go, wow, it's taken me how many decades to pick up this guitar from that first gig at the Croydon Greyhound. And then many years later, you're picking up his guitar and he's saying, what do you think of the new stuff? And you're kind of like going, is this really happening? Yeah, the kid inside you is still...
You were starstruck that day, Nick. You were genuinely...
Oh, yeah. I mean, seriously, because I still had the stars in my eyes stuck there from that very first gig. They were there, imprinted. I mean, and Andy's really good at that. Like, what I've learned from Andy is that connection with fans and people that he knows that have been affected, because I think he's a fan affected himself by things. So, you know, when I went to see with my mate Austin again, we went to the Marquee a few years, you know, a year later or something like that. You know, they invited us backstage and we're sitting on their amps and he was just like chatting. And there we are later. He's incredible like that. He's really approachable.
Yeah, amazing.
Really, and really nice. I mean, a lot of people you've met, the ones that are a bit, you know, they've got that stuff. It's like, you know, you know, you're not coming in. I'm not talking to you. I mean, I've stood by people that have just been so rude to people that have come up to them and said, you know, oh my God, that song just changed my life. And they go, yeah. So, I mean, it's like that. And so you just think, you know, learning from something like Andy, when, you know, you're sitting on the amps and just thinking, wow, they're just really approachable, you know, and they're interested. You know, they were saying, oh, you know, what you know, did you want to come for a meal afterwards? You know, you're just thinking, but I'm just like a fan, you know, it's that sort of stuff. It really taught me early.
And did you must have seen the others, like there was the certainly if you were in Britain, those sort of 18 months or so around the time of Pelican West, you were one of the most famous people in the country. So you must have seen it from the other side where people were completely in bits over approaching you. And you must have been around a lot of...
needy.
Very similarly high-profile artists.
It's a sex symbol. That's what he was, that Hayward fella.
I was a symbol.
You were a sex symbol. And
maybe a ride. I was a 16-inch ride. Or maybe a crash. I don't know. I like those little symbols.
I mean, did you go through a terribly, like, did you manage to resist that, those pressures of fame?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I didn't expect the levels. I thought we were, when it was, you know, in early New Musical Express reviews, it would be like Haircut 100, Britain's answer to Talking Heads. And I remember thinking, yes, wow, this is it. And then there was that moment at your press agents, Judy Totten it was, and she said, guys, do you want to do Oh Boy? You know, and it's like, you start to think, there's a moment when, like, Stardust, you know, David Essex, Blondie, you know, you start to think like that. And I'd been on the bed with my girlfriend, Laura, lying there with her reading Oh Boy. And, you know, I remember seeing actually Andy Partridge, you know, in the centre spread. And I thought, well, it's all right for Andy, you know. And I remember seeing The Boys, because she was, you know, remember that song The First Time by The Boys? You know, they had great plimsolls too. And that's the thing about XTC and their plimsolls. They had really beaten up plimsolls. And that's brilliant. To me, that said, like, pop. You know, if you wore plimsolls, you're in a pop band. I don't know why, but because it was Winkle Pickers earlier on, wasn't it? Shoes are really, really important in pop music. You know, those fine details. And so, you know, you look to the shoes, don't you? You go, I love this band, but, and then you look to the shoes and you go, wow, oh, I can't do it. You know, it'll just be a one-night stand.
Well, yeah. The Beatles did have immaculate shoes. And actually, I always remember Brian Wilson saying that when Paul McCartney came to the session for Vegetables, the Beach Boys track, he says, he had amazing shoes. And it's incredible because he did. He was wearing his, I think it was his purple suede 67 Pepper shoes. I mean, that's a pair of shoes. Jesus Christ.
Purple shoes. Purple shoes.
You know, but he always, and of course, Brian being Brian, you know, Brian will remember the ice cream that day and the shoes. Because that's what Brian loves.
That's the details of, you know, I mean, that's why we all love certain details of songs and stuff. Like you hang on to those lyrics and all the fine stitching.
Well, you're talking about Andy, Nick, and his, I mean, and of course, Dave and Colin and their kindness. I mean, when I first got to know Andy, one of the second or third time we visited him, he went up to his attic before we were leaving. And me and Duncan, it was Duncan Maitland who worked on the early Pugwash stuff and stuff, and worked with Colin, you know, I think Colin plays bass on one of Duncan's album, solo album tracks, kind of. And by the way, just in your introduction, Mark, I am on Say It as well, so I do have the triumvirate.
Oh, of course, yeah. Well, yes, I missed that one. Yeah.
It's okay. It's okay. Well, just because I'm very proud of that. But he got up into his sack and Andy gave me the original Townhouse 4 one-sided acetates of English settlement. Gave them to me. Gave me the 10-inch uncut acetate of Dear God. Gave me Traffic Light Rock Townhouse 10-inch acetate. Gave me Dukes of Stratosphere test pressings. He gave me a swathe of stuff. And I was like, now, of course, Duncan was grabbing them because Duncan's English and he'll just take, you know, the English like to take, you know, land, property. I'm throwing my origins out there. That's all. But honestly, he was like, yeah. And I was like, holy shit, this is, Andy, this is the acetate. This is the acetate for Dear God. This song changed the shagging world. You can't be giving me this. Take it, I don't want it. And I was like, I still have them. I know where they are. They're never far from me. Whenever he wants them back, I'll give them to him. I tried to sell them once when I fell out with him, but that's another story. Because that was just, that was me trying to piss him off. And let's face it, you get on the wrong side of Andy, you've got to fight back. It's the only thing you can do.
That's a Scorpio for you, isn't it?
Scorpio. Oh, yeah.
My mum was a Scorpio.
And the thing, well, that's just all bollocks anyway. That's all business crap because we're friends and who cares about all that? It's ridiculous. But I'm just saying his kindness is just out of this world. Dave Gregory's kindness, out of this world. Colin Moldy. Just, they are, and the thing about it is that's That's something that, you know, people should relax if they ever think, oh, like yourself even, you know, I was so relaxed for you because I knew Andy was going to be so brilliant with you. Because, of course, I was nervous meeting him first time, Jesus Christ. But I went the opposite way. I didn't stop talking. And, you know, you went quite reserved. And I was just like, you know, but Andy's going to be great. You can talk about anything. You start talking about the Bee Gees with Andy in between 1967 and 70. You'd be there all night. And that's why, you know, this kind of, and that's why they're normal.
Oh, wouldn't that be great for Andy Partridge and Barry Gibb to write?
Imagine that.
That'd be great.
I mean, I got a shed in my garden because of Andy, you know, because Andy had a shed. So I got a shed in the 80s and I loved it, you know, and that's where I found my calling in how to write a song, how to structure a song. I covered things like Sacrificial Bonfire, Crocodile, Another Satellite. I always remember covering Another Satellite and being very proud of it because I had a drum machine which had that exact preset drum pattern. Which is a quite famous it's a classic 80s drum pattern preset. And so I remember, but of course I had to try and learn the chords and I was only 18 and I was playing. So I do what Andy did because Andy told me years ago, there's lots of chords in his songs that haven't got names because he made them up. So there's a particularly great one in No Tugs in Our House where I go, no tugs in our house, down there. Oh, dear, dear. That one there. It's just two fingers in a slight D shape somewhere on the fret. And when you play it, it's the fucking chord.
Yeah.
You know, you can't play any other chord.
That's going
over
to the
that.
Horse's mouth. That's going to the horse's mouth for the.
Exactly. And when he showed it to me and I played it, I went, oh my God, that's so brilliant. Because. Chord books for that song will have a certain chord there and it won't be that chord because there's no name for that chord. He just put his fingers there.
They'll not know what you've dampened and the way you've played it, will they?
Yeah.
The chord. That's the thing. Just showing somebody. I've been doing those things on my Patreon where you go, this is actually the way I play Fantastic Day. You know, it's
brilliant.
The simple chords where they're like C and G and D, but it's that thing of leaving the little finger on
exactly.
the top always.
Yeah.
And it's that thing of the way it's dampened and just slight little touches, but that those subtle touches are actually the source. Yeah. I mean, you're talking about presents, but he gave me, do you remember when he, on that day, he gave me Burt Bacharach autobiography.
He did, yeah. Absolutely.
And I wanted him to sign it, which is a bit, you know, I didn't ask because I didn't have the confidence to say, I know it's a Burt Bacharach autobiography, but can you sign it? anyway, and I took it, you know, home, put it on the shelf. So I was renting somewhere at that time above a posh shoe shop in Henley.
Fucking shoes.
Oh yeah, that was it. It was it. I, you know, shoes. It's massive. So I'm in the bath because I always read in the bath because I can't. It's the only place I can read because I focus when I'm in there. So I'm just reading the book and I just loved that book. I mean, it's that thing of, you know, okay, Andy's read this, now I'm reading it, and the details in there about certain little things that sort of happened with songs, because it's that thing of the songwriter. I think there are people that, you know, if you're a songwriter, you know, it's just, you can't help it. You're not going to be good probably in the bank. You know, you're not going to be good with certain things, because it's the way the songwriter's mind thinks. You know, I sometimes think a songwriter sometimes is not, you know, they normally are too sort of like sort of amenable because they have to be open all the time to stuff, you know.
Well, here's another amazing thing about Andy, his recommendations. Now, Andy Partridge is a legend, right? So if Andy says, oh, you should check this out, you kind of get that shiver down your spine because you go, okay, he's my idol. I love him. He's going to recommend something I fucking hate. So how do I deal with this? So over the years, I've just, you know, I'm comfortable with saying I don't really like that. That's fine. But his recommendations are 100% across the board brilliant. And I'll tell you why. One of the first things he ever recommended to me, and I did, and I have to say, shockingly for me, I didn't know a lot about Judy Sill. And this is back in, like, when I first met Andy in oh God, it must have been, well, 2003, around that time, 2004. And I didn't know Judy Sill's stuff. And he just said, I'm going to send you a compilation of Judy Sill. And he sent me a CDR in the post. And I remember going, oh, I have to listen to this woman singing. And I put it on and I literally wept. It's just, and of course I bought everything and I love her and I have everything by her and I'm obsessed. I'm an obsessive Judy Sill fan now. And I just said, Andy, thanks. Thank you. For, you know, shit, and any more recommendations. And he always had incredible
I'm just
things.
Writing it down.
Oh, well. Oh, God,
yeah,
yes.
Well, it's interesting. Lovely. When you do discover Judy Sill, you can really hear it in Andy's writing, his later writing
Absolutely.
In particular, can't you?
Yeah. The Kiss, obviously, being a huge example of that. But just another aside as well, by the way, when he gave you that book in the house, of course, there's me, Mr. Okay, Andy's given me incredible stuff, as I've mentioned over the years, but I'm there going like a five-year-old going, what are you going to give me, Andy?
Aww.
Do you remember? Check out what happened. He says, oh, I don't have it. And hold on, let's go into the other room. And we went into his...
Yeah, Father Santa goes off to the other room and finds something for Thomas.
And he's looking around. Thomas. And I says, can I have the Duke's box? Because I never got that Duke's of Stratosphere box with the jigsaw and all. It's the one I missed out on. And he goes, no, you can't have that. It's my only copy. And I'm like, ah, fuck that. So he keeps going. He goes, hold on a minute. And he picked up an English settlement paperweight. And he gave it to me. And of course, it's brilliant. I love it. And some fan must have made it to him. Now, I apologize to the fan because Andy loved it. But Andy's so nice. He still even went, that's something I like, but you can have it. And of course, I took the shagging. So I left with an English settlement paperweight from that night, and and you left with a board Bacharach book. Paul Putner, when he first went to me, see, mentioning Paul again, Paul is as big a fan, Nick, as you and I and all of us of Andy and XTC, massive fan. As you know, Mark, from Paul's involvement with stuff with you. But when I brought Paul up to meet Andy for the first time, Paul got incredibly drunk because he couldn't handle it. And then we had a brilliant night, of course, and it was fantastic. But he really got stocious drunk. And it was all, but Andy drew a caricature drawing, I think, of Paul and gave it to him. And Paul didn't even know what it happened, couldn't remember that it happened. And the next day, Paul got in touch and said, I woke up with this picture. Did Andy draw that for me? And I was like, yeah. And it's his most prized possession. I know Paul absolutely.
Nick, somebody on Facebook posted a clip of you getting very excited because at the point when the interview took place, you were about to write with Andy Partridge. Now, did that ever happen?
Well, no. But it might happen now, might it?
Yeah, Thomas. Well, yes, but I mean, was this a story originally in the 80s, Nick? Because I don't know about this one.
Oh, yeah. This was, it wasn't writing. What it was I was recording at Air Studios 1983, and it was probably January. And I was meeting up with Andy Partridge in a cafe in Oxford Street, just by Air Studios. And,
wow, that's cool.
Yeah. And he said, we'll be your band. And I kind of did a moment where I just... I couldn't speak because, you know, you saw how hard it was for me to communicate with Andy.
Yeah.
You know, in that thing. And I have this thing. I've not been good. I work on it. I've been working on it a lot lately, actually, and I think I've got to the bottom of it. And I think I've changed it because I just feel it inside. Because I couldn't. I had Andy Partridge say, you know, we'll be a band. And I just kind of froze, like, this moment of, you don't mean that, you know. So he's saying, can we be your band? And my mind is going, you don't mean that. And then I had, you know, Johnny Marr saying, do you want to be in my new band Electronic? And part of my mind saying, you don't mean that. Then I had Paul McCartney saying, do you want to write some poetry together, when I was in his kitchen. And my mind was going, you don't mean that, though, you're just being polite. And so I've had these things in my career where there have been great opportunities to just because you're connecting. I was bonding with all these people. You know, I remember bonding with Johnny Marr really well, and I actually met him in a shop in a couple of years ago.
Shoe shop?
And I think it was a shoe shop. They definitely had shoes on sale in there, but they were a bit expensive. It was, really nice kind of like shop in, where was it? It was just around the corner from the BBC building on the corner. Anyway, I'll get the details and, you know.
So the idea anyway. That didn't happen would have been that they would have been like your recording band, not a live band, a recording band.
Yeah, not a lot of gigs, I wouldn't think.
I think what it was Andy was looking to just like maybe like be that, be a XTC to be the kind of recording band, if you like. And that would have been brilliant.
That would have been amazing.
You know, and funny enough, I ended up working anyway. I was working with Dave Mattox, who ended up joining XTC later. So it would have been probably just Dave Mattox with Andy Partridge on guitar and, you know, Colin on bass, but, you know, it would have been amazing. But
you had Pino Palladino, hadn't you, at that time? And Colin is incredible, but, you know, that's some bass player to try and live up to as well.
Yeah, Pino was a guy that I felt like I'd discovered because I was in a demo studio in somewhere across the road from the one of those gig up in... Oh, these details, they'll join in later. The further away from them, the more sometimes you have to kind of search for them like dropped mail. Where is that? Where is that? Where is it? And I was in a studio and I said, do you know any fretless bass players? Because I was doing the song. I think I was doing Blue Hat for Blue Day, demoing it. And he said, oh, we know this Welsh guy. He comes down sometimes. I'll see if he's around in London. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. It's Palladino ain't a Welsh name.
No, Italian Welsh.
Italian Welsh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah. And so he came down, got on really well, and he played this. He had no frets. And I just thought, but how do you know where everything is? I mean, he just played it like a double bass. So confident, super tall. Yeah. And just, in fact, his new album, have you heard it? It's so good.
No. Wow.
It's really, really, really good. Really cool.
Because obviously Paul Young was huge at the time and he started playing with Paul Young, or had he played with Paul Young? I'm just trying to think, were you before?
No. Because I said, what are you up to? And he said, oh, I'm just looking for sessions and I'm playing with my mate who used to be in, I don't know if you remember them, Q-Tips. And I said, yeah, of course I do, yeah. He said, I'm doing some stuff, half covers, you know, some guy at CBS.
Assigned. A little bit
and of I thought, yeah. And by the time I'd finished the album, Wherever I Lay My Hat was kind of at number one, I think it was.
Now, so why didn't you do Wherever I Lay My Blue Hat for a Blue Day? Why didn't that happen at the time?
Because I didn't have you around to suggest that. You see, we should have met each other way back then.
I was only 12. So I was only 14, actually.
But
well, that's, you know, Andy was suggesting the band. That's incredible, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just imagining them like a house band, like in Sun Studios or something, you know, the house band that just played on everything, on every sort of 1950s rock. You can imagine XTC as the backing band for every, you know, the stock.
Well, you can see the way Andy thinks, can't you? Yeah, that's the way he thinks now, isn't it? I mean, it's like that thing of doing that album, you know, with the fuzzy warbles and then turning it into, you know, my failed songwriting career, you know, with a bit of irony. But it's that thing of, you know, Andy could feed the charts with pop music. You know, that's
can
his
I,
thing,
can
isn't
I
it?
Get a little deep, maybe? Can I throw in a sidewinder here?
Yeah.
Because thinking about it, obviously, if you're talking about 83, the band were disbanding with Terry. Or Terry may have already left, or it was very close to leaving. So just say Andy was suggesting, could Andy have been suggesting to keep the core of the band together because he didn't want to lose Terry and give Terry... Mm. Work and XTC would still be a band, but he wouldn't be playing live. There's a possibility that was a suggestion.
You'd do that, wouldn't you? If you stopped your band playing live because you couldn't perform, you'd want them to keep working, but you couldn't do anything. What could you do? So you'd go and ask somebody in the charts, won't do it.
That's probably a valid totally thing feasible. That he was asking, And I mean, it's another insight into how difficult it must have been for Andy to have dealt with not playing live. The way he felt about the members of the band.
Yeah, so I'd lost one.
And you'd lost your band,
He knew I was a fan, so have XTC. And that was why it was a bit kind of like, you know, because I'd wanted it. I dreamt this was the moment. I mean, I only had to say yes, but I just kind of, yeah, you know, I did what I've done in lots of those situations before.
I'll never forgive you for the Paul McCartney one. You can't be forgiven for that, Nick. You know.
Yeah, I mean, that's it's too much, isn't it? I mean,
it's a heavy one.
There'll be a list if I write a memoir. There'll be a whole page of list of that
things that didn't happen.
Yeah,
you said yes to Andy in theory, though. That's a weird one, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, mainly.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's mainly because Andy is so approachable.
Yeah,
he's got that. He really is, you know, really, really friendly. He's just got that friendliness about him, hasn't he?
The sincerity, you can see
it. The warmth.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I remember sitting on the amp thinking, why is he being so nice? Because you're not used to it in England. And it's not a thing that comes with the territory normally, does mm-hmm. it? You know, especially in punk, you know, you're watching everybody spitting at each other, and then suddenly you're sitting backstage and they're going, these nice chaps from Swindon, who by that time I'd worked out how I was going to get to Swindon. Because I'd looked on the maps and stuff and I'd seen things and I just wanted to go there and walk around the streets because I just thought this was this magical kingdom, you know.
Well, yeah, Andy used to say that people would stand in the laneway. You know, people would stand in the laneway at the back of the house and just look over the gate.
I wouldn't want to go there. That's the thing. I mean, I remember meeting Paul Weller in the street before I was in music and I hid, you know, I hid when he was coming because it was that thing of just not being able to handle it, just jumping out the way or something. So
I'm just thinking that, like Nick, you've got that fantastic description of hearing Neon Shuffle and that being that sort of epiphany. It could well have been, and it would have been for many people. You saw the gig, you moved on, and you forgot about XTC altogether. But you stayed with XTC all of that time, And I don't know. I just wonder whether there was something in that very early moment that you thought this is a band worth sticking with, because they lost a lot of people along the way because of the very interesting routes that they took. They weren't the same all the time.
Hmm. Well, I loved the next album, Go To. Life is Good in the Greenhouse. It was just another moment. You know, when I heard Helicopter, it was the same on Drums and Wires. I was like, every moment. I mean, when I heard Life Begins at the Hop, it was so joyous. I just thought, this is the soundtrack of what's going on at the moment. There was no reason to question it. This was the best band in the universe, as far as I was concerned. So I was following them in that way. And then I started to English Settlement, Knuckle Down. That was my favourite moment on that album.
Yeah, it's a great song.
I just had something about it, you know.
It's very special.
Dum, dum, yeah. And I thought it should be a single. I don't know if it was. Was it?
No.
Single?
No.
Okay. Well, but Roundabout Mama, Lovers of Farmers Boys Wages, which I think is like him being almost like a nature writer, you know, like he is from Swindon and he's a writer and he's just, you know, it started to get more local. Like it's almost like they've gone home and he is writing about his environment then. It's like less about the stars and, you know, or as Andy says, his teenage songs, which, you know, I liked his teenage period because I was teenage.
What a song.
Yeah. Oh, it's brilliant, isn't it?
It's ridiculous. I mean,
The sound of Mama. I really like the warmth of the album. I like that. And then there was albums where you start to, I felt like Andy's voice had been captured really well on certain songs. And I thought, you know, later albums that where it was, you know, he'd kind of, you heard his singing voice because it was almost like affected early on, everything to twist it and make it surreal and shape it around and make a caricature out of it and twist it like kind of Clements out of Alex Harvey Band. It was all a bit, you know, the way he did that face on the video, you know, where it's, we're only making plans and he's kind of this clown,
yeah,
you know, that's doing shapes and stuff like that. And so, well, then I started to not be around for it. And I'm glad because now I have all this stuff to find and discover, because I've had moments where I've gone, okay, and I didn't discover Ladybird until quite late. You know, I think I'd written a song called Ladybird, and then a friend on Patreon who's probably listening to this, Gary Heppel, said, you know, the XTC song. And I thought, did they? I mean, I must have known, but that thing of, you know, but you don't know, you'd forgotten or something or other. And I listened to it and I remember thinking, wow, I've got to up my Ladybird, because that Ladybird is an amazing.
That's a special,
you
know, Ladybird.
Chucking my Ladybird in the bin. Well, I'll do a rewrite on that.
Do you hear a connection in your own music to XTC? Because I would say I don't, but I mean, I don't in Haircut 100 stuff. I possibly would do. I was just listening to Love is the Key by the Sea off Woodland Echoes, and that I can imagine that sitting alongside a sort of Apple Venus type of track. But I don't think you wear your influences on your sleeve in that way, or do you?
No, I don't think I do. I don't know why. They should be there, but they are mostly on Woodland Echoes, because, and maybe it's through when, as you get older. I mean, Andy seems to have got, you know, released more of his Beatles stuff, because I didn't get into the Beatles until 1982, so I hadn't had any of that early stuff with them. I got into them on the Haircut 100 bus, you know, that's where I got into them. I was just listening to them endlessly, and just discovered them kind of thing. Because beforehand, I'd been listening to everything that was around at the time. And by the when I was younger, I suppose I was born in 1961, they'd split up by the time in 1971.
I think, Nick, the Beatles, they're the COVID-19 of the music world, because I think. Let me finish the analogy.
Yeah. Where are you going to go with this one?
because they're airborne. They're everywhere. They're airborne. Yeah. You pick them up without knowing you're picking them up. And I think with your music, I totally understand that you didn't get into the Beatles until 1982, but there's no way they didn't go into your system subconsciously, you know, COVID-wise, before that. Because your melodies, you've got these beautiful melodies, you've got those little nuances. It's you, of course, but there's a pop sensibility that only the Beatles gave to the world, I think. Personally?
Yeah.
And I might be...
Penny Lane, isn't it? It starts from Penny Lane, you know, that the joy of Penny Lane.
Yeah, because you must have heard Penny
Lane
when
you were kids. It's all encapsulated in that song.
Yeah, and it just went in and you said, oh my God, this is something incredible. But you didn't consciously say it. You just kind of... Because I remember hearing... Like, all the Beatles songs I knew weren't even singles. How is that fucking possible? How could I know all the lyrics to 8 days a week or You're Gonna Lose That Girl? They weren't singles. You know, Drive My Car. Everyone knows Drive My Car. That was never a single. You know, it's just, they went beyond. So to me, they were airborne. But I agree. I totally respect that you didn't get into them as a band till 82. And that's incredible, really, because your pop songs are incredibly catchy. And, you know?
I was thinking the same
thing. Cheers, Thomas. Thank you for that. That means a lot.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing as Thomas, because if there's two things that link you and actually link the Beatles and link XTC, it's your gift for melody and your love of melody. And you know, the Haircut 100 singles were all fantastic tunes. And I think one of the things that sometimes people miss in XTC's music, and certainly at the point that you were listening to them, Nick, in 1978... is that you just hear the angularity, you just hear the noise, you just hear the unpredictability of it, and you forget that actually beneath all of those songs, beneath all of that noise, that there are still good tunes, even on White Music and Go To.
Yeah, when you're near me, I have difficulty concentrating.
Drums and wires, Nick, don't jump ahead. Drums and wires.
Well, it's funny, because as a fan, I was thinking... I was thinking, why don't they have that initial plimsoll and
that image that
I'd seen? Because I liked that kind of like Rock Goes to College early sparse stage, the H&H amplification, the Ibanez Artist, you know, this kind of like college pop, thing I'd liked, where they were like, looked like the Feelies a bit, but a bit of Talking Heads and stuff. And that kind of art school look, image, I really liked about them. And I wanted them to continue that. So I felt like that wasn't helping them with the hits in a certain period, because I thought they had a really good, you know, like the Ramones hit on a really good image. You know, like that was really good what they had. The leather jackets and, you know, the drain pipes and the plimsolls. You know, it was and the hair. And I felt like XTC had this image like that. And I thought, because that's what I got into it as well. It was a big part of it. So I thought round about that time, they weren't helping themselves because they were searching for an image, it looked like, and photographer and stuff like that. So I thought they looked like, with songs like This Is Pop, and I felt like the production on This Is Pop was heavier than it should have been. The mix was a bit...
It's a muddy mix.
You know, and stuff. And I just thought, wow. And I had this view of how they were. And the same happened with Talking Heads. They very quickly evolved for me. And they were kind of leaving that college bookish thing that I'd initially been attracted to and liked bands like The Yachts and other bands. And they were going... And that's what I liked about The Police, because they looked a bit like that. And all these bands that were very simple and had simple stuff were going very complicated. If only I'd have actually worked with Andy and learnt more lyrically with him around about that time, because I was very literal. And what I loved about Andy was how poetic he was and how off the planet some of this stuff was. But, and I remember at that time being kind of like, yes, I was a commercial artist and I thought commercially, but I definitely wasn't as learned as Andy at that time. And I could have learned a lot off him in that way, because, you know, the way he put things together. So, you know, that conversation, say if I went back in an about time, back to the future kind of way, I'd go back to that cafe and I'd be chatting to for hours about that. And I'd say, you know, can you help in that way? Can we work together? Can you teach me?
Would you have taken on the advice, though, at that stage?
Yeah.
Because you were a big
star. No, not then. Not then, but, you know,
in hindsight.
About time kind of. Okay. Yeah, in hindsight. I'd go back in my spaceship that we're going to build, the three of us, Andy, yourself and I, and we're going to travel back in time and do it all right.
Well, that sounds good to me. Yeah. Well, can I just say then, can I just throw this in as well? We must talk about Colin Moulding, because... You know, obviously this is an Andy love fest because we love him and we love Dave and we love Colin. But when you talk about the songs, there are songs in the XTC catalogue that had changed our lives, and they were Colin Moulding songs. And especially to me, when I got to hear like Colin's demos, because, you know, Andy's demos are famous. The famous thing was that Andy's Nonesuch demos leaked out well before Nonesuch became a thing, and all the fans got... Because I went to the XTC convention in 1990, flew over on a Ryanair flight from Dublin with John Aldridge, the footballer, on the same flight. Thank you very much.
Wow.
And went to Altrincham and had the time of our lives at this ridiculous, wonderful convention. And that's where I picked up some bootlegs, which was the demos for Nonesuch. But also going around looking at the XTC artifacts, the Colin's bass, his old little bass, Andy's acoustic, you know, stuff like that, artwork that they all left out for fans to see. There was demos playing in the background, and I heard the Find the Fox demo, which was the Sunrise Sunset demo, Find the Fox. And instead of just going, glang, 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 which is one of the, that melody, I'm getting goosebumps even singing the fucking thing. It's such a beautiful melody, that Find the Fox. He sang Sunrise, Sunset over that melody. And I literally stood in the hall as a 19-year-old and went, oh, fucking hell. This guy's fucking demo from his bedroom. And it sounds like this is better than McCartney. It's better than Lennon. It's better than fucking anything. I wanted that demo. I spent years trying to track that fucking demo down. And I finally got it. I didn't get a great quality copy of it, but that the sound of that demo made me want to make music. For real. And I wanted to make music for years leading up to that, in a way. But Colin Moulding's songs have this effect that's even, in a way, as important, if not more important, than Andy's. And Andy's just off the scale. He's so good. But
do they work together? I mean, no. do they do the Lennon McCartney thing?
Or no, is it?
Because I felt like Lennon McCartney, when they worked on, like, I Want to Hold Your Hand, it encapsulates more the Beatles. It's like two heads coming.
Absolutely.
With Andy, Thomas, how does it work with Andy when you've collaborated with him? What's that sort of collaboration like?
It's funny, Mark, because we might write a song with Andy now, because I just sent Nick an idea, and it is a case of, can you throw something in? But sometimes needs must on a song as well. And honestly, needs must is not a bad, you know, phrase, really, because sometimes it really works. Sometimes it works. Yeah. I agree with Nick. There's nothing like if me, Nick and Andy sat in a room, we'd have such great fun and we'd come up with some great things, I'm sure. And there's nothing to compare to that. But in the world we're living in, especially with COVID and everything that's going on, this is another way of doing it. And it can sometimes bring up, because in fairness, I'm very proud of a song like Anchor, which I wrote with Andy. But Andy rang me one day, because Andy, when we first got to know each other, Andy would ring a lot because he'd love to leave telephone messages. That's what Andy loves to do. Loves to leave 2-minute long phone messages. And I used to love it because I recorded them all, would you believe? Because I'm a fan. You know, I wasn't erasing those messages. I was fucking recording them off the phone. But one of the ones I recorded was Andy left me a birthday song. This is my birthday, and I wasn't in. I was out getting pissed, obviously, in the old days. And Andy said, well, you're not in, but I'm going to, here we go. And he goes, Thomas Walsh is the birthday boy. La, la, la. And that's the verse of Anchor. And I took that and I went, I'm going to write an entire song around this to show Andy Partridge I'm not some gobshite from Ireland who can't do stuff. So I did, and I really honestly wrote one of my best songs, because I wanted to show Andy I can be a person that can come up with quality. I'm not just a big fan, which of course I am.
So he didn't even know he was collaborating on that one.
When me and Andy get together and we write, I have to record it just audio-wise. Because we'd never remember what, because Andy goes, blah, 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 and he comes up with amazing melodies and they're gone if you haven't recorded them, because they go. Mm. Even if he says, play that again 30 seconds later, I've forgotten it.
It would be different.
Yeah. He's forgotten it. You know what I'm saying, Nick? So basically, I did that in a lot of the audio chats we do. I'd have a little dictaphone beside the phone. And then I'd just go back at the end of the conversation, the end of the phone call, and I'd listen back through the hour and a half, and I'd go, okay, I'd stop the tape there and I'd record this little section. And it was like my genius. He went, you fell for my genius. Da, 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 da. And I just took that and then I wrote the song. And I'd send Andy the clip of what he wrote as an MP3, and then I'd send the demo. And I'd say, here you go. Here we go around again. He never knew he'd come up with the verse melody because I found it on a tape. So he was delighted with that. At the Sea, we did a lot together, which was great fun. But 3 or 4 things I've done with Andy, maybe 2 or 3, maybe, I've written a couple of years later when I've listened back to tapes.
And another similar question is, how does it feel, journalist question, how does it feel when you open up whatever it is you open up and you have a Dave Gregory string arrangement that you hear for the first time on one of your songs?
Well, I'll tell you what, Dave has... God almighty, where do I start? I love him so much. He's such a friend. He sends me birthday cards, Christmas cards every year. And I feel like shit because I never send him anything. I'd send him stuff, but I don't send him stuff. I say, Dave, I spent enough money on your fucking music over the years. Give me a break. So, no, but I tell you, his string arrangements are mind-bending. That's just the first thing. But check out what he did on the track Here, which is one of my songs. He did the string arrangement. I had a little idea for the string, so I sent him a little hummy demo, because that goes back to the Bee Gees again. I always remember reading years ago when I was a kid that the Bee Gees hummed their string arrangements in the 60s to Bill Shepherd, and he wrote the boom. So I went, that's the way I'm going to do it, because I'm not going to write music, because I'm not fucking talented enough. So I'd hum stuff. So I sent a hummy kind of idea to Dave, and he wrote this incredible score. But Jenny, check out what he does. He goes, I just thought it could maybe do with a little bit of a lead break. So I've actually sent you something, but you don't have to use it. Me and Keith put it on. We put it up in Pro Tools, but this is back in 2007 or so. And it was a double-tracked lead break on Here. Now, I'm going to put the song up later, actually, on my Facebook and stuff, because that album's coming back out on vinyl next month, so I'm promoting it a little bit. Listen to the lay break that he said you don't have to use. Just fucking listen to it. It's like something Todd Rundgren couldn't do in a billion years. And he just did it and sent it, and he said, you don't have to... I remember getting back in touch with him and saying, if you were beside me, I would have swung for you. Because I got so annoyed. It was so beautiful. It was just like, how could you say, don't listen to that? Jesus Christ. I remember pushing it in the mix. Every time I would mix it, I'd push it in the fucking mix. It's so good. And that's the talent of the man. And that's the genius of the man. He doesn't even know how fucking brilliant he is.
I was only going to ask because I enjoyed Hard Day's Neck. So, you know, with the On the Rollerblade singles, you did the Beatles covers.
Mm.
What's that? Yeah. I don't know about that. Hard Day's Neck?
Yeah, I tried to do them as...
Serious?
I just felt them, yeah.
Why didn't you give me a copy of
that? Yeah, they're good.
So I have to find a copy of that now.
I got Andy Bell from Oasis and Ride playing the guitar.
Oh, did he, with his
SG. He did all the lead stuff. Playing George Harrison.
What would you choose if you picked a couple of XTC songs to put on a CD? Not that people do singles like that anymore, but what do you think you would choose? And Thomas as well, I suppose.
It's all right, Kevin. I want to hear what Nick has to say.
Well, I did. I sang Statue of Liberty at Rob Stringer's birthday party, 50th birthday party. And it was weird because it's the weirdest audience ever because it's a birthday party. And there was Sade, Manic Street Preachers, you know, and, brilliant. You know, it was every manager you could think of that you'd probably want to manage you know, from Roger Davis, Tina Turner's manager and Adele's manager and everything. And they were all there. And I played Statue of Liberty for Rob because I know he's a huge XTC fan.
Yeah,
I mean, he's like, seriously, that's the lovely thing about Rob. He is a super fan. He's not kind of like your average music business person. You know, he really is, like us, he really is a fan. You know, I mean, he's when probably everybody's talking about, you know, the business side. He's probably he's putting on his records, you know. I mean, he'll send something to me like, I'm listening to Imperial Bedroom, Town Crier. What a song. It's got me in tears. You know, that's not a normal music business person, you know, in that way. So that's why it's lovely. And so I sang it blew him away to play it But it was that moment where I just thought, I'm not going to get signed, am I? No. It's like the showcase that you just know, you know. Yeah, it's great, but I'm not going to get signed. It's like, it was a weird thing. And it never crossed my mind that I was even thinking like that until it's that moment where you're standing on stage, you've got all these people and you're looking around in front of you and it's like the weirdest gig ever kind of thing. And then you just think,
If only you'd have played Travels in Nylon, and then it would have all been different.
Home of Safari.
What couple of tracks would you cover then? Give us a couple. Do you think we get the Nick treatment? By the way, Haircut 100 Umbrellas. What about that?
Ah, very good, very good.
100 Umbrellas. Would it be 80s? Would it be 90s? Would it be, you know, would it be 70s? Because let's face it, you know, 90s, we have Nonesuch and Wasp Star. We have Nonesuch and Apple Venus.
Life is Good in the Greenhouse. I would sing Life is Good in the Greenhouse and make it. Because, you know, it's, I've sung it before and I've just, you know, because I'm often humming it. La, 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 la. And then... Life is good. It's kind of like you can actually make it a bit more, you know, because he was singing it like it was kind of like chet 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 chet. He was spitting it out, wasn't he? You know,
angry. Sound,
da, da, da. Yeah, it was like, you know, life didn't sound that great in the greenhouse. So I'd do it more of as a gardener who was enthralled with his seedlings. You know, and, you know, this was, it was a beautiful day and I've got a walled garden. I'm the happy gardener, you know, and so I'd sing it that way. So there's that, but I could go through, if I took a breather, you know, went for a pee,
yeah,
and came back, I would probably have a long list and an album together of, you know, songs that I would love to do.
But if I was to start at XEC, right, a track off White Music, I'd do New Town Animal in a Furnace Cage, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'd do Mechanic Dancing off Go To. Drums and Words, I'd do That Is The Way.
Right? Yeah, I think you do Mechanic Dancing brilliantly. That would really suit you.
Could give it a go, I have to say.
Yeah.
That is the way that is. I love that song so much. So I'd do that off Drums and Words. Black Sea, where do you start? But it'd have to be something like, I'd do Don't Lose Your Temper. It's on the extra tracks on Black Sea, so I'm going to go there. English Settlement, okay. Oh my God, where do you start? But you know what? I think I'll stick with you with Knuckle Down. I'll go Knuckle Down. Mummer, Oh My God, Me and the Wind for a Laugh. Just because it made Dave Gregory's fingers go inside out. Me and the Wind on the piano. Big Express, I've Got to Do Wake Up. It's just, what a song. What a way to introduce an album. Mm-hmm. So Wake Up.
Mm.
We won't do Dukes. We won't go there. Skylarkin. Oh, God almighty. Fuck it. Earn Enough For Us, right? Earn Enough For Us. Skylarkin. Mm-hmm. Then Oranges and Lemons. Cynical Days. Fuck it. Go calling on that. Non-Such. Oh, my God. Where do you start? Omnibus. Fuck it. I said it. Omnibus. Right. Omnibus. So then, oh, my God. It's Apple Venus. Jesus Christ. Harvest Festival. Fuck it. Harvest Festival.
Ah.
Wasp Star. This is the last XEC song I ever thought I'd get into, and now I'm obsessed with it. The Wheel and the Maypole. So I'd go Wheel and the Maypole, and there you go. Every album, one track. Fuck it. Round of applause for me.
Well, yeah, we've got a concert there, I think. And well, I'm just going to round it off because I've just been thinking of somebody. You know, we could have fantastic day in, day out.
Oh, brilliant!
Love Plus One on a Farm Boy's Wages. And
that's not bad.
Whistle Down the Wind Will Still Be Beautiful or something. I've been having a very fantastic time with Kevin, with Nick, with Thomas. I want to thank you all so much for being such good company as well as such big fans, and this has been a tremendous conversation, some of which will be released
good luck editing.
Thank you very much. We'll have to do this again because it's been great.
Oh God.
Yeah, well,
thanks so much. You know, it's a dream.
I'm learning so much as well. I mean,
it's an educational experience.
Next time I do it as well, I would have dived in more because I've got things to discover as well. There's lots of stuff I still haven't discovered.
No, but
you know, only this morning I got into Then She Appeared.
Oh, like, fantastic!
I knew it, but I just didn't know it as well as I do now.
It's glorious. It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
What do you call that noise?
That was fun. Thanks to Nick Haywood, Thomas Walsh and Kevin Burt, and many, many thanks to the podcast supporters on Patreon who make it all possible, including the following Knights in Shining Karma: Terry Arnott, Matt Bell, Kevin Burt, Liam Duggan, Jamie Dunn, Helen Fay, Peter Fermoy, Leslie Gooch, Robert Graham, Marek Kraus, Jesper Kumberg, Robert Lawlor, Dennis LeCourier, Liz Lynch, Ian Morris, Yusuf Mura, Amy Parkinson, Murray Meikle, Kevin Murray, Karen Neal, Mark Reed, James Reimer, Simon Slatehome, Michael Sutcliffe, Mark Thomas and Nigel Waller. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/Mark Fisher. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back next month with more. See you then.